Limon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We were robbed. That might be what every single Dodger fan in LA is screaming at the top of their lungs today. Major League Baseball says the Houston Astros used cameras to steal signs all throughout the 2017 season, including the World Series when they beat the Dodgers. We'll hear what happens next and how deep this baseball scandal goes. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, it is Oscar Day and the nominations are out, but many immediately cried foul over who was not chosen for the accolades. We'll get into all that analysis in about 15 minutes, but it is actually a perfect backdrop for the segment we start today with, an area where Hollywood continues to come up short, and that is in representation. Between 2007 and 2018, only around 3% of top-grossing movies featured a Latino lead or co-lead, and this despite the fact Latinos make up about 49% of Los Angeles and are considered one of the nation's fastest-growing populations. That also happens to spend a whole lot of money at the movies. That lack of representation has led some Latino industry leaders to take action. Today, some took a major step, a partnership between those leaders and the office of L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti. The pairing is called L.A. Collab, and it works to connect talent with content producers with the goal of doubling Latino representation in Hollywood by 2030. L.A. Studios, KPCC's podcast production vehicle, is also part of that effort. And for more on the partnership, let's talk to Beatriz Acevedo, co-founder of L.A. Collab and founder of the Latina media company Me Too. Beatriz, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, it's well known right now that people of color aren't well represented in Hollywood. And I just want to start by asking why you think that is and why, after so many years, it continues to be the case.
I think the answer is pretty obvious. We are not in the positions of power. We're not inside the studios as studio heads or network presidents making the decisions of who gets to tell the stories that are important to our community. So when while that continues to happen, it is going to be very, very challenging for us and for our community to move forward. And that's why this effort is so critical to us, to accelerate the access and the representation for Latinos in entertainment.
How much of the excuse of Hollywood being a big business that is risk averse holds water for you?
Well, I don't even understand the question because obviously Latinos are 25% of the box office. So I always tell brands and networks and studios, imagine if you tried, right? Latinos represent 20% of the U.S. population and being 25% of the box office when we're represented very, very minimally at 3% is pretty ridiculous. If we saw ourselves represented, if we saw our stories, if we saw our entrepreneurs, if we saw our leaders, imagine how much more you could get from us. And I think, you know, saying that it's risk adverse, I would actually argue that the opposite is how people should be thinking about when Latinos are driving every single metric that matters when it comes to growth of our economy. There's no company that will survive in the future without being in business with Latinos. This is the demographic that is the youngest. This is the demographic that is growing GDP. This is the demographic that is growing consumption rate. This is the youngest cohort. Now, Gen Z kids are the majority in this country. So if you want to keep your business alive, if you want to keep your brands thriving, you need to be in business with Latinos. So yes, if you're risk adverse, this should be your first priority.
Now, you're one of the co-founders behind LA Collab. What led you to take a concern that you and many of your colleagues have and turn it into something aimed at helping others make their way in Hollywood?
Last year, we were at Sundance. Very happy to see some progress in some of our communities of our brothers and sisters in the African-American community, in the Asian-American community, but yet our own stories and our voices were not there. And, you know, at first we were angry. After that, we complained in numerous panels at Sundance, and then we complained on social media, and we thought this is going to get us nowhere. So either we stop complaining or we really rally behind an initiative that you know, unites our community. We need to start doing things in a more unified way when it comes to all of the Latino groups that already have been doing all this work on the ground for so many years. And they do a great job, but together we definitely could be much more stronger. And to my point at the beginning, that we are not the ones at the top making the decisions at the networks, at the studios, at the streaming services. We need that allyship. We need our friends, our non-Latino friends who are in those positions of power to help us reach our goal. Diversity, equity, and inclusion should not fall only on the shoulders of the underrepresented, but it should fall on the shoulders of all of us who do have that access.
How will this collaboration work, and how will it specifically fix the problem we've outlined here? And actually, then, what's more important, the having the decision makers at the top that are brown or in front of the camera?
I think it's both. I mean, our goal is to double, not just in front of the camera, but behind the camera as well. Obviously, jobs are very important for our community, specifically in an industry like Los Angeles, that there is so much money made out of the entertainment industry. You know, our community needs to be a part of that as well. How are we going to fix it? Listen, La Collab or LA Collab is not going to fix this by itself. And we get this question all the time. Together, we can fix it with collective impact. You know, that very simple equation that 1 + 1 is much more than 2, we feel is very, very powerful. If we all work together, if we all have the same goals, if we don't point fingers to say, listen, Hollywood, you're doing a horrible job, you should be doing better, without being collaborative, without helping to provide those tools on how we can all do better. If Hollywood does better, our community will succeed. So our goal in LA Collab or La Collab is to specifically sit, and every studio, every network, every streaming service has very different needs and very different pain points. So it is our intention to meet with each one of, now we have over 60 partners, and we launched today. So we are incredibly excited, and more people can join in at lacollab.org or lacollab.org. There's many ways that people can support the initiative. You can be an ally, you can be a mentor, you can be a funder. There's all ways that you can give your time. We want to know from our community and from Hollywood, what do they need and what can they give? It should be a back and forth collaboration.
Talking to Beatriz Acevedo, co-founder of LA Collab or La Collab. A USC Annenberg report on Latinos in film made the case that erasure, not included, is the norm for Latinos on the screen. How would you define that, and what effect it has, say, on someone that is young, a young generation of Latinos, say they're just barely entering their teens and not seeing their faces represented on a screen?
That is mortifying to me. And I think, you know, with my previous company, Me Too, that's exactly what we were trying to solve for. You know, it's this young generation that is U.S. born, to, you know, be American, to be in this country, and to never see yourself in media. That has a psychological impact for sure on how kids perceive themselves, on their own self-esteem. How could you now be the majority of a Gen Z generation and never see yourself on screen? I mean, if you go back to basic human needs from that very famous pyramid from Maslow, belonging is right there with food and shelter, right up there. So to not feel like you belong in your own country because you are nowhere in media, and whenever you do see a few images of yourself in media are not positive, that is a big crisis for our community.
One more thing, Beatriz. When it comes to this support that Latinos do have for Hollywood, we've seen stats over and over the years that Latinos go to the movies, they support television. How much will it take for Latinos to say, look, we're not going to keep buying this product up if you don't represent us on the screen? Because ultimately, Hollywood can say, look, you guys are buying it. You guys are spending money on it.
I think we need to do a lot of education also within our own community. I think we really need to empower our Latino community to know how worthy they are, how powerful they are with their pockets. I don't think we believe that ourselves about us, how much we contribute to this country. You know, so I think it's going to start with a big campaign also into know your worth and know your power. I think that's incredibly important as something parallel that we want to be doing with La Collab.
Beatriz Acevedo is co-founder of La Collab, which will work with LA Mayor Eric Garcetti to connect Latino talent to opportunities in the entertainment biz. Beatriz, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, now an update on a baseball cheating scandal. Let's take you back to October 24th, 2017. There was an electricity pumping through LA that day. It was game one of the World Series at Dodger Stadium, the first time they'd been back there in almost 30 years. The Dodgers were coming off their winningest regular season since moving to LA, as they had won 104 games, and now the team was facing the best team in the American League, the Houston Astros. Series wound up going a full seven games, but the Dodgers lost, and the fans' dreams were dashed. Now, however, it could be argued that the Dodgers didn't lose that series versus the Astros as much as it might have been stolen from them. Today, Major League Baseball announced that after an investigation, it found the Astros had cheated all throughout the 2017 season and through the playoffs using camera-based sign-stealing systems. Molly Knight is a reporter for the sports website The Athletic. Her most recent book is The Best Team Money Can Buy, the Los Angeles Dodgers' wild struggle to build a baseball powerhouse. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, now the Astros are accused of sign stealing. What does that mean? How did they do us? Walk us through the mechanics.
Okay, so basically every team is allowed to, or at that point was allowed to, have a camera feed in center field that they controlled. They could use for teaching purposes. They could look at it to help their hitters or their pitchers with their mechanics, totally above board. The Astros figured out a way to send that feed directly to a monitor, a television monitor near their dugout, decode the signs, train the camera on the catcher's signals, his hand signals, decode the signs for fastball, changeup, slider, other off-speed pitches, and then bang a trash can instantaneously to let the hitter know what pitch was coming. So it's pretty intense, pretty crazy.
Now, as punishment, the league issued some suspensions. What happened to who?
Okay, so they decided basically that they weren't going to be able to punish players specifically for this. They think most players were involved, but it was impossible to figure out who cheated more than other guys. So what they did was they banned the manager, A.J. Hinch, for a year, or suspended him for a year, and they suspended the general manager, Jeff Luno, for a year. Now, neither one of those guys was named to have been the ringleader behind the system, but MLB basically said, look, you guys should have known better. We warned clubs against using tech to steal signs. It was your job to make sure that your players knew and that they weren't doing it, so we're going to suspend you guys. Now, after that happened, the owner of the Astros, Jim Crane, held a press conference and said he was taking it a step further and firing both. So it's a pretty stunning turn of events today.
And who else down the road might be found culpable? Someone with Dodger ties?
Yeah, well, not so much Dodger ties, but ties to the next World Series the Dodger lost. Alex Cora, who is currently the Boston Red Sox manager, was the bench coach for Houston in 2017. And he, according to the report, was the ringleader behind this this cheating system that the Red Sox, or that the Astros used to steal signs. So he is facing a lengthy suspension. Also, MLB is looking into whether the Red Sox used technology to steal signs in 2018. Now, what the Red Sox were alleged to have done was not as serious or severe as what the Astros did, but it still would have been illegal. So Cora is looking at a long ban.
We're talking to Molly Knight, sports writer for The Athletic. Molly, how big of a problem is this sign stealing in Major League Baseball?
Well, obviously it's an enormous problem if the commissioner is going to spend a team. You know, the Astros have been probably the best team in baseball over the last 5 years, and they've only won one World Series title, but this puts a huge asterisk next to it. And so for the commissioner of the sport to go out there and publicly say, you guys cheated during the season when you won, I mean, the hit to MLB's brand that causes, it must be so severe that he's willing to do that, to try to come up with penalties to deter teams from ever doing this again.
You know what? I've been a baseball fan my whole life, traveled with a major league team for 10 years. So I've kind of been in this thing for a while. Baseball and cheating have historically gone hand in hand, Molly. It's just kind of the way the sport works. Yeah. I mean, baseball kind of looks away at some kinds of cheating when it comes to like scuffing a baseball or adding your own saliva to a baseball. But then certain other things they come down hard on. How much is the culture of the sport to blame here?
It's definitely to blame, but it's also this weird thing where, for some reason, baseball seems to be held to a higher moral standard than other sports. because just look at like PEDs and steroids. I mean, nobody really cares when an NFL player gets suspended for that. But in baseball, it's like the guy is forever tainted and jeered. But you're right. Cheating has been going in baseball, has been going on since as long as the sport has existed, whether it's pine tar or spitting on the ball, guys using amphetamines in the 70s, yeah, called greenies, PEDs. Now we're on the trash cans and perhaps wearable tech. It's just, I mean, some teams, I mean, I know the Astros believe that they weren't the only team that was doing this.
Oh, now, no. I'm convinced, Molly, almost every team does something, but they're just not caught yet.
That's the thing. It's either that the Astros took it further than everybody else, or that they had more disgruntled former employees than anyone else willing to sell them out, which also speaks to the culture, which the commissioner today laid out in his report that their culture is somewhat lacking in the way that they treat their employees. So something to be said for taking care of people and being nice to them as well.
How much, though, Molly, goes to the larger issue in sports, that the stakes are so high, fame and fortune?
Yes.
I mean, the contracts are so gigantic. The incentive is there to cheat. So how do you overcome that?
I don't know that you can, to be honest with you. I mean, even with the steroid stuff, if there's some guy who's maybe barely going to make a roster and he could take some substance that will make him, give him a full-time job and potentially lead to him earning millions of dollars and being able to provide for his family for a long time, for generations, I just don't know that potentially facing a 50-game or 80-game suspension and being embarrassed is a big enough deterrent to stop that guy from trying to do that. I mean, this is pretty severe today. I don't know. I think AJ Hinch, the manager of the Astros, is very well liked in the game, and he'll probably somehow land with some kind of a job in a front office at some point soon. But the Astros GM, Jeff Luhnow, it's pretty tough. I mean, fair or not, he's not well liked amongst his peers. And I don't know if he's going to be getting another job soon. So his punishments are pretty harsh.
Molly, one last thing. During the height of the steroid era, Major League Baseball, looking back, was accused of looking the other way. There'd be a ball player who'd be 160 pounds 1 year and then be 250 pounds full of muscle the next year, and they turned the other way. They came down hard. The Major League Baseball came down hard today on the Astros. Maybe it'll come down on the Red Sox. Is this a sad day for baseball, or is this a day where they decide, you know what, we're going to do something about it when people cheat?
I mean, I think it's both. I think it's a really sad day. And Dodger fans are just all in my Twitter mentions, just in a really dark place right now. And I get it. I mean, that was the closest they've ever come. You know, we all watched Kershaw get pummeled in Houston that year, and he'd been so good at Dodger Stadium. I mean, winning that World Series solves a lot of problems for Dodger fans and him and the team and everyone. So it's a sad day. It's a sad day for Houston fans. My God, I mean, they didn't ask for any of this. My friend there said they've got three championships now, and two with the Rockets when Jordan was playing
baseball.
That's
right. Oh, my gosh, that's
all
right.
All three.
They're all tainted, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, but that being said, hopefully now we can all move forward. It's a sad day. I don't think any fan base is feeling good right now. Maybe teams that hate Houston, but certainly not the Yankees, Red Sox, or Dodgers, who all lost to Houston in the postseason. It just brings back painful memories.
Molly Knight, sports writer for The Athletic. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, from cheating in Major League Baseball to the Oscars. Now, not accusing anyone that got an Oscar nomination of cheating to get that nomination, but there are some controversies afoot as far as who did not get nominated. We'll get into all that coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. In the wee hours of the morning, actors John Cho and Issa Rae announced the 92nd Academy Award nominees.
For achievement in directing, the director's branch of the Academy nominates The Irishman, Martin Scorsese. Joker, Todd Phillips. 1917, Sam Mendes. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino. And Parasite, Bong Joon-ho.
Nice.
I did it. Thank you so much.
You did it.
Congratulations to those men.
That's right, those men and only those men, because no women were selected for the directing category. Only one person of color nominated among 20 acting nominees. Wondering if this is now Oscar So White Part 2. The Frame's John Horn and The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan are here to break down this year's nominee. Hello, both of you.
Hello there.
Hi.
All right, let's start with the directors. Five nominees, none of them women. John, one of the big oversights in the directing category, Greta Gerwig, who directed Little Women, which was adored by both audiences and critics.
I think a lot of people feared this was going to happen, and it happened. I think the surprise here is not only that Greta didn't get in, but that Todd Phillips, who directed Joker, got in. That had the most nominations of any film with 11. But Taika Waititi, who directed and co-starred in Jojo Rabbit, didn't get nominated as well. But this is a real problem. Last year was one of the best years ever for female directors, not just Greta Gerwig, Lulu Wang. We had Hustlers. We had Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. All these women doing great work, and none of them were deemed good enough to get into the best director race. Hollywood loves sequels. This is a sequel I think the Academy wishes it wasn't involved in, excluding women from its directing nominations yet again.
Rebecca, what do you think? We even talked about this last week, how when it comes to nominations and what maybe is an acceptable amount for people not to get upset, you said one would be nice, right?
Right. I mean, well, so this is the 87th time that the Academy has nominated all men in its directing category. So that's a lot of men. An interesting thing to note in the case of Little Women, clearly the Academy saw the film and liked the film. Little Women is nominated in Best Picture, Adapted Screenplay. Two of its actresses are nominated. It's got some below the line nominations. So it begs the question, did this movie direct itself?
No.
Yes.
Well, that's right.
The answer is yes. And yeah. Then we can get to some other movies that appear to have acted themselves. I'm thinking of Parasite and Farewell, but that will come up in a moment.
Yeah, and I always wonder how sometimes that works when it comes to a film that, say, gets nominated in a certain category but then doesn't get nominated in another. I always wonder if the two shouldn't connect. So, like, if something's nominated for Best Picture, shouldn't the director be nominated as well?
In olden days, they had to be the same because there were five Best Picture nominees and five director nominees. Now we have a sliding scale where there can be as many as 10 nominees for Best Picture, as few as five. We had nine this year, so there are going to be four films that aren't going to be nominated for the direction. That said, you got to say that Greta Gerwig did a great job directing Little Women. So I don't know. I have some ideas, but I think there's some people who maybe you could substitute out and put Greta Gerwig, and I would also say Taika Waititi in.
Rebecca, you spoke very highly of The Irishman and of 1917. John, you have spoken great things about 1917 as well. Rebecca, when it comes to the people that actually did get nominated, is this a good solid list outside of not nominating Greta Gerwig?
Well, sure. I mean, these are all strong films. I think one thing that's interesting about the directing category is that all of the men who are nominated are well known to Academy members. These are men who've been working, making films for many years, unlike a newcomer like, say, Lulu Wang, who directed The Farewell, or Melina Matsoukas, who directed Queen and Slim. And that's a significant part of what comes into play is, are these people Academy members are already familiar with? Now, John mentioned Todd Phillips, who directed Joker. Phillips is best known for directing the comedies in the Hangover series. So this is a sort of jump for him in terms of how he's perceived in the industry. But nevertheless, a lot of the people who vote on the Oscars know Todd Phillips, and that matters.
And maybe in a move that foresaw this backlash coming, the Academy points out that a record 62 women were nominated, on almost a third of all nominees. In what category are those nominations, John?
Well, I mean, obviously, 10 of those people are actresses in the lead and supporting parts. And there were some good nominations. Hildur Guðnadóttir became only the ninth woman nominated for composing composing film music. She was nominated for Joker. And if you start looking in costume design and things like that, yes, some women were represented, but they weren't represented in the right categories. And to echo what Rebecca talked about, the Academy has tried and has invited a lot more younger, more diverse people into its voting membership. The problem is, as Rebecca knows from spending a year with me at the LA Times researching this, the Academy is old and white and male, and it's like the mob. You don't get kicked out. You're in for life until you die. So even as the Academy is trying to change the membership demographically, it's really hard because it's so big and it's so old and so white and so male that even as you change it, those older members remain and they're continuing to vote.
You only become a made man, right? You don't become a made woman, exactly. Apparently. Yeah. We're talking Oscars with Rebecca Keegan, with The Hollywood Reporter, and also host of The Frame, John Horn. All right, so let's get to the diversity matter. This year being called Oscar So White Part 2, the argument in the past was diverse films weren't nominated in the past because there were no diverse films, but that really wasn't the case this year.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
Manette is dying.
She doesn't know, so you can't say anything. The family thinks it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better?
Chinese people have a saying. When people get cancer, they die.
All right, that's from The Farewell, starring Awkwafina. Film also well-received by audiences and critics alike. Completely shut out of nominations. Rebecca, what happened with that one?
I really don't know. I mean, that's a movie that A24 did a really good job marketing. It performed well at the box office. Critics adored it. And it just seems that either Academy members didn't see it or it didn't connect with them, which is really too bad. I mean, one thing that may have hampered the film is that there's a lot of subtitles, which unfortunately can be a deterrent. However, another movie with a lot of subtitles, in fact, all subtitles, is Parasite, the Korean movie, which broke a lot of barriers. So I'm really scratching my head a little bit about The Farewell.
John, how much of this do you think, now with Netflix jumping into making movies, that there's so much more content out there, that there invariably will be some movies that are good that are just not going to get nominated because there are not enough nominations to go around?
Well, that is true. But also, if you look at the Netflix movies, The Irishman, Marriage Story, and Two Popes, not a lot of people of color in those movies either. And I think the interesting thing about both The Farewell and Parasite is that none of the actors in these films were nominated. And I think Parasite is a really unusual case because I think Bong Joon-ho is probably going to win for directing that movie. It's in the Best Picture race. It could even become the first foreign language movie ever to win the top trophy. And yet, like, who acted in that? Was it a bunch of people that did really bad work because the movie's great, and yet none of the actors in that film are recognized? So I think there is a blind spot in terms of seeing a movie but not seeing its cast, especially when that cast speaks a language other than English or doesn't look white.
Now, on the point of Parasite, the internationalization of the Academy, historic nominations with Parasite, and also in the documentary category, Rebecca, can that be at play here with the list of nominees?
I think it's a major factor. I mean, we've talked about the Academy since 2016 has had this major push to invite new members. They've been focusing on inviting women, people of color, and members from abroad. A huge swath of the new members have been international. And I think one effect of that has been more of an openness toward a foreign language movie like Parasite. But I think one other effect that may have is that it is hard to get screeners and movies to people all over the world. So to the extent that people are able to see the movie, particularly in a short award season like this, when they are far flung and on sets, you know, all over the globe, that's a factor as well.
Now, Rebecca, you were with the LA Times, as John mentioned, when they did a deep dive into Academy membership. And since then, major efforts to diversify, but things still seem to be a bit of a hit or a miss. Are those efforts not enough?
Well, you know, I think it takes a long time to change an institution that is as old as the Academy is, just like it takes a long time to change all kinds of institutions. We'll find out, you know, the Academy had set these goals of doubling its number of women and doubling its number of people of color by 2020. So when they invite their 2020 class, usually in June, we should have a clear sense of just were they able to reach those goals. And then I think it will be a few years before we really see the full effect of that changing the nominations.
Is this, John, as Rebecca mentioned, a generational shift that eventually when people wind up dying, for lack of a better word, that a new generation with maybe different perspectives will be able to write this a little bit.
I'd like to think so. But if you look back at last year's Academy Awards, we had Mahershala Ali winning for Green Book, Regina King winning for Beale Street, the production designer, the costume designer for Black Panther, both African-American women winning. So yes, and the fact is that a movie like Parasite getting the attention it has received maybe 5 or 10 years ago, that wouldn't have worked out if the membership of the Academy was the way it was then. That said, you can really look at everything and say change is really slow. And compared to last year, this year is a step backward. And the Academy can't decide what movies are made. They can only recognize work that is produced. But it is a joint effort. And if the Academy recognizes movies made by underrepresented filmmakers and actors, then Hollywood starts to mirror that and it all becomes, you know, one kind of circle of progress.
Rebecca, is today a good or bad day for the Academy?
I think the Academy would probably have liked to have seen some more diversity in the nominees and also some more stars. I mean, J-Lo, for instance, was overlooked for her performance in Hustlers. J-Lo's been to the Oscars a lot. It would have been nice to see her there as a nominee. Beyonce also was overlooked, another person who would have brought a lot of eyeballs to the telecast.
That's Rebecca Keegan with The Hollywood Reporter and host of The Frame, John Horn, putting all things Oscar nominations in context for us. John, Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's often a lot of stress when figuring out childcare, where you put your child while you have to go to work, how you're going to pay for it, how you're going to trust the people that you're paying to take care of your kid. That's something we're going to get into when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, lots of news to get to all afternoon long here on KPCC. Nick Roman, host of All Things Considered, is here to tell us what he has coming up for the late afternoon.
Well, we'll tell you about Governor Gavin Newsom's task force to end homelessness. It's out with its report in the main headline. That task force is calling for a mandate to end homelessness on the November ballot. It'll force cities to house the homeless or face lawsuits. Josie Wong will take us to Chinatown, where a longtime Vietnamese restaurant's closing down to make way for new luxury apartments. It's another sign of how development is changing immigrant communities. And a New York Times analysis of social studies textbooks from California and Texas shows big differences in what kids are learning based on the state's politics. And all of that comes up when All Things Considered arrives at 4 o'clock after Marketplace at 3 and The Frame at 3:30.
My wife grew up in West Texas. They learned Texas history before U.S. history, she told me.
Yeah, well, you know, in fourth grade in California, you learn all about the missions. I know that's a case. Yeah. So, there are regional differences for sure.
That's Nick Roman, All Things Considered this afternoon. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, Amy Martinez. Finding affordable childcare is often a struggle, but parents aren't the only ones dealing with the financial burden. KPCC's Mariana Dale talked to childcare providers about the strategies they use, including dipping into their personal finances to make ends meet.
The sidewalk leading up to the front door of Sylvia Jordan's Eagle Rock Home Daycare is painted red with blue and green footprints. A mural of a tree overlooks the back patio where the children play.
Every time we have a recess, you know, like a holiday, I use those times to start painting every space of my house. And I want my house to look like a museum, you know, for the kids.
Jordan has run her business for 15 years. Right now, she watches 6 kids. The youngest is 3 months old. She sometimes works a 12-hour day. And after paying for groceries, utilities, her 2 assistants, and supplies, Jordan estimates she makes less than minimum wage.
We're not working for money because there is not money. We're working for the passion we have for the kids.
Just getting reimbursed for what little money is available means hours filling out paperwork. It's another burden for small-scale operators like Jordan, who by one county estimate account for nearly a quarter of LA childcare spaces for kids 0 to 5.
Quality childcare costs more than any one funding source pays.
Gina Capito is a childcare consultant. She worked with the county's Office of Child Protection to analyze how providers handle the dozen or so state and federal programs available for low-income families.
Different state-level funding streams even function differently. All of this can become more burdensome to actually use the funds.
Because some funds are restricted to specific purposes, even while established providers can struggle with the system. Sarah Soriano is the executive director at Young Horizons Child Development Centers. The nonprofit just celebrated 50 years in Long Beach and serves about 400 kids. Its main sources of funding are federal and state contracts.
The funding barely is enough, and sometimes not enough, to pay the basics.
The county's financial analysis of more than 100 providers found that on average, there's an annual gap of $4,000 to $8,000 per child between the actual cost of care and the public funding available. Soriano bolsters state funding with money from foundations and donors. Staff costs are more than half the center's $4 million budget.
The extra funding that we seek is to be able to give staff better wages, be able to offer benefits, be able to buy the program materials, the things that we need.
A 2017 LA County report found early educators earn an average of $14.65 an hour. Soriano says at Young Horizons, some entry-level employees make minimum wage, and teachers earn between $18 and $20 an hour.
I just wish I could give them so much more than that.
While larger organizations can hire employees to write grants or seek donations, small home care providers have fewer resources. Sylvia Avalos has run a home daycare for 2 years. She says there's less than $1,000 in her bank account and she's opened credit cards to stay afloat. We talk sitting under a fruit tree in the front yard of her Compton home while her assistants watch the kids inside.
A lo mejor la batalla que yo veo mucho es específicamente en el salario.
Avalos says she lives day to day, and the biggest hardship is how little the state reimburses her to care for each child. For example, California caps weekly reimbursements for infant care to $232 for child care homes in LA County. Avalos is hopeful that a new law that allows some home providers to collectively bargain with the state will bring needed changes.
Nosotros nos vamos a empoderar más.
She says she feels empowered to fight for more professional development and higher salaries. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
All right, moving on. A new bill aims to make beverage companies more responsible for their waste. The Beverage Container Recycling Act of 2020 is meant to address California's struggling recycling program. In the last 6 years, half of the state's redemption centers have closed, with supermarkets mostly bearing that burden. The new bill would task drink distributors with recovering and recycling those used bottles and cans. Senator Bob Wieckowski is the bill's author. Senator, welcome to Take Two.
It's my pleasure to be here today.
All right, to give us some background, the largest recycler, Replanet, closed last August. Why? And how did this all evolve into the recycling crisis we have now in the state?
Well, California's recycling program, which started in 1986, has become quite antiquated. And one of the basic things that we do is we put the burden on the consumer and also the redemption centers to receive the nickel that you paid for your can or your bottle, because we tie it to the price of the material. So as the price of aluminum has gone from $90 a pound to $40 a pound, that's not put on the distributors or the manufacturers. It's all on these redemption centers. And so you don't have that shared responsibility that we want to have through all the elements of the ecosystem.
How much of this has to do with China deciding not to take our recycling products?
Well, that was a big deal, but that was inevitable. What happened is a lot of the waste haulers negotiated contracts with the cities that they're going to go to a single recycling container. In the old days, you separate your glass from your plastics and your tin and your paper. They put it all in one, and they told us, oh, it's okay. So what happens is your mayonnaise glass breaks. It gets on all the paper and everything, and none of the stuff can be used. And the problem is that waste management and whoever else is haulers, they're in the business of having landfills. You know, so we've got this conflict between the people who's doing the recycling and the people who's collecting the garbage. And that compounded the situation that we had with China, because China doesn't want our dirty waste. We have to own up to the fact that we have bad practices. So by taking out the really valuable material, the drink containers, then we can have the waste haulers and folks focus more on our cat food cans and the mayonnaise and those other containers.
Talking to California State Senator Bob Wieckowski. All right, let's get into the details of your bill. How does the program work?
Well, what would happen is that CalRecycle gives up the operation of the recycling program. We turn it over to the distributors because we know people make sodas and beer, but the people that distribute it have the contact, the first contact in the state of California. And they set up this stewardship program. I just got back from Oregon and went through the Oregon program, and it's unbelievable where they have these vending machines that you can go in and easy breezy feed the bottles in there. They have the barcode that's marked, and then you get your little receipt, or you can go and get cash. You can actually get the cash right there on the day that you want to get it done. CalRecycle, the government, is just there to do an audit and to make sure that they're meeting these goals. But the private industry runs the whole program. I mean, you think about it. They deliver your beer at the grocery store or at the corner store, then they're going to pick up the empty bottles.
What's the response been from the beverage industry about your plan?
Well, I had a similar bill 2 years ago, and, you know, they objected to it because, you know, although the Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola can do this in Europe, they're doing it in Norway, they're doing it in Oregon, they're doing it in Canada, they don't want to do it here. But I think they see the writing on the wall that in a world of climate change and the world of limited resources and all the challenges that we have, this is a rather low-hanging fruit for the state of California to proceed on. So,
ideally, how would this fix the issue that California is dealing with?
Well, you immediately would have private industry who is responsible for this going in and making the investment on these bottle centers and recycling vending machines immediately. You would have all the big players, you know, the Costcos and the Targets and the Walmarts and Safeway and Vons and all those people saying, okay, we see how this is going to go. We want people to come into our stores. We want to make it convenient. If this is the way California is going to go, so they'll make that investment and be part of the program.
And just one thing, just to be clear, on the manufacturer's end, the drink manufacturer's end, what's the incentive for them to take part in this, to really do this?
It changes their culture that they're going to be designing products that are easiest and cleanest to recycle. It helps them meet like the minimum content requirement that California has and other jurisdictions have. And if they don't participate, they can't distribute their products in California.
Where does your bill stand right now? It's supposed to get discussed on Wednesday, right?
Right. So it'll go to the Environmental Quality Committee on Wednesday. There'll be a vote, and I'm confident that it'll get the necessary votes to go out. By the end of the month, it's going to be on the Senate floor for consideration, and it's a majority vote. It needs 21 votes.
That's California State Senator Bob Wieckowski of Fremont. Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, some folks have stopped drinking milk because dairy products and everything that goes along with making them leaves a pretty big carbon footprint on the environment. Now, I know what you're thinking. I drink almond milk, so I'm okay. But would you still down a quart if making that almond milk could be responsible for the deaths of billions and billions of bees? Find out when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Every February, bees from across the country come to California, where 80% of the world's almond supply is grown. They're being shipped in to pollinate almond orchards in the Central Valley, but it's a ritual that actually leaves them hurting and even dying in the process. Annette McGibney recently wrote about this for The Guardian. Her piece is called "Like Sending Bees to War: The Deadly Truth Behind Your Almond Milk Obsession." Annette, welcome to Take Two.
Yes, hi, thank you.
So Annette, why are the bees dying off? I don't mean to sound flippant on this, but is almond pollination that demanding?
Bees are dying off for a multitude of nuanced reasons, but the demands placed by the almond industry on bees is definitely stressing them, along with other stressors like climate change and pesticides.
What kind of stress and pressure does that put on the bees?
Well, bees generally have a hard time surviving the winter. It is their dormant season. And so in my reporting, I interviewed a beekeeper here in northern Arizona, where we are at 7,000 feet elevation. So those bees, you know, if they stayed in this environment, they wouldn't be waking up until later in the spring. But, you know, the almond season starts in February. So the bees have to be sort of literally woken up out of their dormant season to get out there and pollinate the almonds. So these beekeepers start the ritual by feeding the bees sugar, like corn syrup, to get them going. And then they are put on trucks, big flatbed trailers, and, you know, driven potentially thousands of miles across the country. So that's stressful for the bees, just being on a truck like that. And then they are put in holding yards. And so these bees are all stacked up together. So if there are parasites, there's a varroa mite is the most common that can cause the bees to get sick. And so viruses from those mites can spread from one beehive to the next. So if you've got a beekeeper who has infected bees and he puts his bees next to your bees, then it's probably going to spread. And so that's very stressful for the bees. My reporting showed that most almond growers, you know, they're paying a lot of money to have these bees brought in, so they don't want to do anything to kill the bees. But there's a lot of other agriculture going on in the Central Valley, and they're using pesticides to protect their crops. So the bees, they can travel to other farms and pick up deadly pesticides there that make them sick, and they can take those pesticides back to the hive, and that makes the whole hive sick. So there's just a lot of threats that bees are facing.
Now, what's the extent of the die-off? Can we estimate how many bees have died from all this?
So a report came out about 6 months ago that stated one-third of commercial bees in the United States died last season, and billions of bees die every year just from pollinating almonds, not directly, but probably mostly indirectly.
Why do the bees have to come to California Central Valley to be part of the almond production business?
So something that I found was fascinating to myself, and I'm a big consumer of almonds.
Sure, me too. That, yeah, a lot of people are.
Right. And is that it just never dawned on me that the bees needed to pollinate almonds would need to come from outside California. But it turns out the Central Valley of California is not a good place to keep bees. It's too toxic from pesticides, from all types of agriculture. And so the bees are kept in Texas, in North and South Dakota, in other places across the country where they're stored during the winter, and also where there's nice forage for the bees in the summer. And so the bees have to come from other places and are trucked across the country to pollinate the almonds. So it's kind of a ritual almost of the beekeepers loading up all their bees from all over the country. Something like 70% of all commercial bee hives, beekeepers, and their colonies are shipped to California around this time, you know, starting in January, so that they're in the almond orchards in early February.
And we've been told over the years how maybe it's good for us to transition from dairy milk from cows, to different kinds of things like soy milk, or in this case, almond milk for the things that we drink. So I'm wondering how much of all this is driven by consumers' demand for almonds and almond milk.
It's very much driven by consumer demand. And I do want to emphasize, though, that dairy milk has a much larger environmental footprint than any kind of plant-based milk. So almond milk is more environmentally sustainable than dairy milk, at least traditionally produced dairy milk. So consumer demand is really high. We've all seen it over the course of 5 years. I've watched almond milk becoming available in only, you know, like organic food stores, yeah, to now you can get it at a convenience store at a gas station. And so the almond growers are very much trying to meet this consumer demand, but it's not just coming from the United States. 70% of the almonds grown in the Central Valley are exported from the United States. So even though the United States is the largest consumer of almonds, there's a market all around the world for almonds.
You know, Annette, when I was a kid growing up in the 80s, and I used to watch the news with my grandpa, he would get frustrated watching the news because he would say, everything's bad for you nowadays. So you can't have anything anymore. You can't enjoy the things you used to enjoy. Everything's bad. If I were talking to my granddaughters today, I would say something similar, but here's the difference. I would say, there's a dark side to seemingly everything that you buy in the supermarket. What should we have in mind going forward when we think about our food choices?
I mean, anything done on a mass scale has a dark side. So moving forward, I think we need to value balance and diversity and doing things as consumers that protects balance and diversity, rather than just wanting every product, every, you know, type of fruit, you know, blueberries in the dead of winter. We can't expect to have all types of food at cheap prices when we want it, and also protect the environment. So as consumers, we need to understand that maybe we're not going to be able to have all our food choices if we want to protect the other creatures on this planet.
That's Annette McGivney, Southwest editor for Backpacker Magazine and journalism lecturer at Northern Arizona University. Annette, thanks a lot.
Yes, thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. You can always find us wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. I'm also on social media at amartinezla. That's at amartinezla. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.